Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KALW's radio magazine of the performing arts. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. Today, I'll be talking with actor and dancer Justin Jenna about his lead role in the musical The Boy from Oz, in which he portrays the most famous gay man from Australia, entertainer, singer, songwriter Peter Allen. Boy from Oz, directed by John Fisher, is for Theatre Rhinoceros. I'll talk with composer, singer, and performance artist Holcomb Waller about the San Francisco premiere of his Requiem Mass, A Queer Divine Rite, an evening-length choral work honoring those who have suffered persecution due to their sexual orientation or gender expression. It's at Grace Cathedral next weekend. I'll also talk to violinist Karen Gomio, who will be performing Shostakovich's Violin Concerto No. 1 with the San Francisco Symphony, led by Czech conductor Jakub Rusa, in a program that also includes the Second Symphony by Alexander Borodin and the Suite from the Miraculous Mandarin by Béla Bartók. Concerts are tonight through Saturday at Davies Symphony Hall here in San Francisco. Plus, our regular contributor and critic at large, Peter Robinson, will review two series that are streaming online on Netflix, the BBC police drama Bodyguard, and on Amazon Prime, The Romanovs, from Madman creator Matthew Weiner. Also on Peter's review list this week is the movie Can You Ever Forgive Me, starring Melissa McCarthy as the best-selling celebrity biographer Lee Israel. Stay with us. Music from Holcomb Waller's Requiem Mass, A Queer Divine Rite, a monumental choral work created by singer-composer Holcomb Waller. It will be making its San Francisco debut Friday and Saturday, the 16th and 17th of this month, at Grace Episcopal Church up on Nob Hill. My guest, the composer, Holcomb Waller, has authored and produced scores of evening-length theater-based interdisciplinary music performances and has been presented and commissioned by a number of the country's leading arts institutions. His film score work includes music for the Sundance-selected documentary We Were Here in 2011 and the two-part short film series Dare. He recently completed a Northwest regional tour of Notes from the River Keepers, an elaborate sung history of the high-risk transportation of fracked crude oil by cargo trains through the Columbia River Gorge. In addition to his interdisciplinary work, he has self-released five albums on his own label, Napoleon Records. Welcome, Holcomb.
Thanks, David.
Happy to have you here. Well, this presentation is more than a concert. Per se, tell us a little bit about its conception.
Yeah, it It was originally conceived as just an intervention into institutional religion after Prop 8 passed. And I was collaborating a lot with musicians who very commonly are hired in churches to be singers, music directors. And we just like this idea of maybe adding a queer voice to the canon of Christian liturgical music. And I actually collaborated with a dean in Portland to kind of conceive an evening-length choral work, and we thought a Requiem Mass was a fun way of kind of returning the concert form of the 20th century of Requiems back to its ceremonial roots, and then to fully theatrically and ceremonially stage it in the cathedral. So that's sort of how it was conceived, and that's what we're doing at Grace Cathedral.
How much of the actual Latin Requiem Mass are you adhering to in terms of its format and structure?
Well, whenever you do any Mass, it's like you're DJing the various sections of the Latin Mass that are available to you, and there's like 16 or something. We do, I think, 8. So, for example, we don't do a communion section, but which would typically be part of a service, but I was like, oh, the staging of that's going to be complicated. There's going to be crumbs everywhere. So I can tell you the sections we do. We do a lot. Some of my favorite ones are the Dies Irae, which you just played an excerpt from, the In Paradisum, the Ascendance into Heaven, the Pia Jesu, the Libera Mei. I retranslated all of the Latin texts, and then I typically mashed them up in each section with another text that was a little more queer relevant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So a thoroughly modern presentation of even what might be familiar to some in some of the movements of the Requiem Mass.
Absolutely, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Tell us how the choruses are assembled for the presentation.
Well, here in San Francisco, Yerba Buena Center for the Arts and Grace Cathedral partnered to really deeply engage the community and to allow the community to shift and shape the presentation. So we actually had community engagement choral workshops, which were free and open to the public since last June. And we had about 15 of those. And then from the people who showed up, the choir just manifested. And about 50 people will be in the choir, about 41 from here in San Francisco, and then about 10 traveling down from Portland, sort of the alumni. We're going to have a little mixer party.
So Portland is where it was originally presented and conceived?
Yeah, in 2015.
Other performances or future performances planned?
Yeah, interestingly, it's going to Sydney in February as part of the Sydney Gay and Lesbian Mardi Gras, which is their kind of their pride festival. So it'll be in a big performing arts concert hall there.
Mm-hmm. Well, take us back to the premiere in Portland in 2015 and its creation there.
Yeah, well, there we actually did the same process where we workshopped for about a year in these public community engagement workshops. And actually, I devised the music during the workshop process. So sometimes we do writing exercise or extemporaneous music games and then create sections sort of in the workshop. And then sometimes I'd also just bring new music to a workshop and we'd work on it. But the workshop participants are kind of responding to a call to invoke the peaceful repose of people who have been persecuted for their gender or sexual diversity. So they're coming to the table with a lot. A lot of them are ex-Catholics, for example, is probably our biggest draw.
Recovering Catholic myself.
Yeah. And so when they have an opportunity to re-explore a Catholic ceremonial form in a big European cathedral, though Episcopalian still has all the smells and bells that might make you reminisce about your childhood or whatever, they have a cathartic experience where they're getting to reinvent and redefine some of the things that maybe alienated them or even traumatized them. Mm-hmm. So those are things we brought up in workshop. And that got incorporated into the piece.
Right.
Yeah.
Does it surprise you that you still encounter so many stories of people that have had these encounters in 2018 or even 2015?
Well, at the macro level, yeah, I can't believe it was 2018 and we're still fighting for equity for trans people or job protections for queer people in half the states. But yes, I have to admit that it doesn't surprise me. I think what actually surprises me is the sense of satisfaction with where we're at that comes from a lot of institutions that fund these kinds of things, like the Ford Foundation revoking arts funding for LGBTQ-themed things in America because after marriage equality, you know, we've arrived. It's like, well, that kid in the South hasn't arrived. You know, so it doesn't surprise me that we're where we're at, but I think what does surprise me is that it's fallen from the priorities culturally. And I think if you look at LGBTQ community, the people within that community who are most marginalized are profoundly marginalized. And we kind of forget that. They're not all just like wealthy gay men getting married or to-do lesbians in Berkeley getting married and having kids. They really aren't, you know.
Everyone's story is unique, that's for sure.
Yeah.
I'm very intrigued by the work that you did about the fracking, Notes from the River Keepers. Is that sort of thing, the social activist, the calling attention to things that are perhaps marginalized, your forte, so to speak, when you come to create things like this?
Well, that was a project I actually did after Equimass, and they're similar in that I think lately my interest has been in engaging institutions that aren't normally partnering with arts organizations. So in the case of Requiemmass, it was these wonderful religious institutions, which really are also community and performing arts organizations in their own rights. But in the case of the piece you're talking about with the oil trains, I collaborated with a group called the Columbia River Keepers, and it's one of the many River Keeper Alliance organizations that protect waterways, and those institutions deal with coal and oil train transportation, which always happens along waterways because they're flat. So that just emerged out of my partnership with that institution, and the biggest and most profound thing that had happened for them was this derailment of a fracked oil train in a town called Mosier, and it blew up and caught on fire and almost incinerated their school while it was in session.
Wow.
And they just don't have any rights to protect themselves from this kind of transportation because of the way the federal government works and the system being overseen by the federal government, the way it was set up in 1865 when Abraham Lincoln created the Pacific Union Corporation. So it's just, there's so much fascinating history that people aren't aware. And it was my opportunity to basically give voice to this history that these embattled organizations like Columbia River Keeper just don't have the ability to do. You know, they only have this much of people's attention spans, but I can bark at them for an hour in a theater.
That's true.
Yeah.
Is that a work that has some legs? Are we going to hopefully see some partnerships in either the Bay Area or elsewhere for this further presentations?
I hope so. It'd be great. We focused on doing regional touring around all of the small towns that were most impacted by crude oil transportation. So it was like lots of small presentations. But yeah, we've talked about bringing it to schools. Because it's an interesting convergence of like journalism and singing in the arts and like environmental activism. So
sure.
It's fun. You cover a lot of education. It starts 350 million years ago with the formation of oil and then moves through to like the derailment in Mosier. And so it kind of spats the history spanned within the hour.
Mm-hmm. I mentioned at the top that this is more than just a concert presentation and multimedia is involved. Tell us a little bit about the scenic work that's done with Eric Flatmo and your collaboration with him.
Oh, yeah. We're doing a beautiful sort of visual art install. Grace Cathedral has an incredible visual art program generally, and they've let us sort of hang this series of 14-foot constructed balloon letters and in the space and light them, and it's a part of Eric's conception of the scenic design being elements of party materials, but very very formally presented within the church to sort of span that space between the reverence of the ceremony with the kind of irreverent and party culture that I think so often people who are persecuted have to kind of rely on to survive. So you know, it's a really beautiful thing just to see. It's my favorite part of the show is the balloon installation. That's no, not true. The chorus is my favorite part of the show. The people actually I'm working with. But when the day comes around, just seeing those balloons, which say LGBTQ, hanging in the space is, I don't know, it's just hilarious. And it's beautiful.
Yeah. And that's an amazing space, Grace.
It's so beautiful.
Yeah. So the it's at Grace Cathedral Episcopal Church, of course, the top Knob Hill.
Yeah.
The 16th and 17th at 7:30. Mm-hmm. Tickets are available at?
YBCA.org.
YBCA.org. It's the Requiem Mass, a queer divine rite created and conceived by Holcomb Waller.
I should also say a plug on Sunday at 9:30 a.m. at Grace Cathedral. That's this Sunday. They're doing a conversation with me with the dean about the piece, and at 11 a.m. in their service, they're presenting Fauré's Requiem, which was a Requiem Mass in the 20th century intended for ceremonial presentation. And and they're actually presenting it at their 11 a.m. service on Sunday. So it's going to be a kind of fun week that spans these two things.
Indeed. Well, yeah. Congratulations on that.
Yeah.
And your collaboration with YBCA, a great organization.
Yeah.
You did mention that you reconceived some of the text from the Requiem Mass. We're going to go out with In Paradisium. How did you perhaps alter that text or retranslate it and give us, for those that aren't familiar with the In Paradisium movement from traditional Requiem, set it up for us?
I'm not sure we'll get to this point. The first part you might play is an excerpt from the Song of Solomon, actually. So that was one of the alternate texts, which is the most beautiful sort of earthly love reference you can get in the Old Testament. But later, the In Paradisium at the end comes in, which is kind of like, the way I translate it is much more like a command, like, this is how you get to heaven, as if someone you love was dying in front of you and you were screaming at them how to get to heaven, you know, like, head for the gates, turn right, look for the martyrs, go right for the angels. So that's how I translated the
crucifixion, line to the right, crucifixion.
Yeah, just head right for the angels, you're going to heaven. So I translate it as directions.
Music from Holcomb, yeah. Waller's Requiem Mass, A Queer Divine Rite. Thanks for coming in, Holcomb.
Thank you so much.
Music from Holcomb Waller's Requiem Mass, A Queer Divine Rite, the 16th and the 17th up at Grace Cathedral Church atop Nob Hill. YBCA.org for more information. And Grace Cathedral has a number of additional activities around that. You can go to gracecathedral.org for more information there. A very good afternoon to you once again. I'm David Latulippe. Still to come, Peter Robinson will have some movie and video reviews for us. I'll talk with violinist Karen Gomio, who's performing with the San Francisco Symphony this week. And next, well, The Boy from Oz is a raucous musical biography about the life of the most famous gay man from Australia, entertainer, singer-songwriter Peter Allen. Featuring songs written by him and with other collaborators. You'll recognize some of them, I'm sure. Tunes like Arthur's Theme, Don't Cry Out Loud, I Go to Rio, among many others. This jukebox musical is in its final 2 weeks of performances at the Gateway Theater through Theater Rhino. And it needs a dynamic, multi-talented performer to take on the role, a role that won Hugh Jackman a Tony and Drama Desk Award back in 2004. Well, they found that person and hit a home run in the form of Justin Jenna in the title role. Justin is an actor and dancer from Madison, Wisconsin, who danced with the Milwaukee Ballet before coming out to San Francisco to study at ACT for the Master of Fine Arts program, where he was in a number of performances there, as well as with the Oakland Ballet and San Francisco Symphony performance of Broadway's On the Town. This is Justin's first production with Theater Rhino. Welcome, Justin.
Thanks, David. Thanks for having me.
It's quite a role to take on. And, you know, we should first talk a little bit about the background of The Boy from Oz and Peter Allen, because it has, just in the title, a number of double, or shall we say triple entendres associated with it, Boy from Oz. So tell us a little bit about Peter Allen.
Yeah. Peter Allen was kind of, he's a kind of rags to riches story. I like to see him that way. He really came from the outback with not much, a small town, Tenerfield, Australia, and he found his way to Hong Kong. He had a television career in Australia before he left and went to Hong Kong and was found by Judy Garland. And I think that's
hence the first entendre.
The first entendre
Oz.
For Oz. Yeah, exactly. Right. And then fell in love with her daughter, Liza Minnelli, got married. They were married for about 7 years. This is the time he started writing a lot of songs and singing and starting to make a career for himself. And, well, obviously that didn't work out so well. He went back to Australia for a time and kind of recouped and really found his sexuality and started incorporating that into his music, and that's what really launched his career into his further singer-songwriter.
Mm-hmm. Were you familiar with Peter Allen before this show, really?
You know, I knew the hits. I knew
but did you know there were Peter Allen's hits?
some of them. I Honestly Love You, I had no idea that that was a Peter Allen song.
Same here.
But I knew Don't Cry Out Loud and Arthur's Theme, and I was aware of Peter Allen because growing up as a young dancer, Hugh Jackman was a huge inspiration to me. So looking at his body of work, you know, this musical often came across my radar, and I said, oh, you know, what is this? What is this show? What is this all about? Who is this Peter Allen guy? And, you know, it was one of those things growing up, I was thinking, you know, oh, I could never play that role. I'm not Australian, you know, why would I ever, you know, pass into that realm? But, with the help of my dear friend, Larissa Calloway, she plays my mother in the production. She's a native Australian, and she helped me with my dialect immensely. So
you do have to take on the dialect.
You got to take on the dialect.
All right, the rest of this interview is now in Australian.
All right, no problem. I got to do that later tonight. We'll try and keep it American.
What's the hardest part of that, of making sure you keep on that dialect?
The hardest part is definitely in my scenes with my co-star Justin Lopez, who plays Greg, my boyfriend from Texas. So he has a very strong Texas accent, and he hits all of his R's really hard, and I can't hit any R's whatsoever.
That's true. Yeah.
If I start to slide into his dialect, it's the hardest. The hardest thing is, you know, being in a scene with somebody else who's in a completely different dialect, mm-hmm. and you're just trying to navigate the waters because you want to slip into their dialect, sometimes you like take the, you know, the middle road where someone speaks American and you're speaking Australian, and then I'll end up somewhere in Northern Ireland or something, which has happened several times. Then I just, you have to sit there and like,
and that's where director John Fisher comes in.
Yes.
I should just give a plug
Absolutely.
Out to John. He's an amazingly prolific mm-hmm. and multi-award winning playwright whose plays have been performed in New York, LA, across the country. He last appeared in Lear in July of last year. He was at the United Solo Festival in Manhattan in his one-man show, A History of World War II, which he won a Best Actor Award for. Mm-hmm. So kudos to John for going that. Yeah. We'll be talking with another theater, Rhino production of his next week here at San Francisco. He and his very production of A History of World War II. So,
yes. I got a chance to see it in New York before I came out here to do this, and it's a really fabulous piece. Mm-hmm. It's extremely funny and fast paced, and he really does explain the whole history of World War II. But it's interesting because you think a lot about World War II, but he has so much detail, and he tells it through such a wonderful personal lens of his own, and he's a very talented actor and director. I've really enjoyed working with him. He has a strong vision right off the bat. He knows what he wants. Mm-hmm. And he gets it. Mm-hmm. For sure.
You talked a little bit about your co-actor in the mm-hmm. production. What's it like? Tell us about your interaction as your duo entertaining team.
With
your brothers, right? No, you're not. You're performing artists together. You're this Texas accent gentleman.
Oh, yes, Justin Lopez. He plays my Texan boyfriend.
Ah, okay. Yeah.
Greg. And Greg doesn't come in till the second act, because the first act is full of Liza Minnelli and our marriage and the downfall of that. Yeah, this is actually Justin, I believe it's his first play musical that he's ever done. He's a amazing singer. He's in the Gay Men's Chorus. He has a fabulous voice, and he's really kept me on my game, definitely, because I come to this realm definitely as an actor and a dancer. But, there's 30 songs in this musical, and I sing 24 of them, and a lot of them with Justin.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a tour de force, for sure. The piece is, 2.5 hours long, and I think I leave the stage for 10 minutes. Mm. So really, in the end, I end up relying on everybody else who's coming on and off the stage to, help me through it, because I find that the more a musical relies on one character, if it's centered around one character, the stronger the chorus and the other characters around them need to be. Because there are moments where, I get done with a monologue after finishing a song, after a previous scene, and I just look at the audience and I go, I have no clue what comes next, I'll be honest, I don't know. And then someone comes on stage and just starts talking to me.
Boing,
and I'm like,
the trigger.
Right there. And, this cast is very, very talented, very diverse. I'm honored to be on the stage with many of these actors, singers, and dancers, and it's been a real pleasure.
Justin Jenna as the star role of The Boy from Oz at the Gateway Theater through Theater Rhino, directed by John Fisher, who will be my guest next week. I'm sure we'll talk and praise you more next week as well. And it must be challenging with all that energy you've got to put on stage to be witness to all of this wonderful weather out here and realizing you got to be ready for your show tonight.
Oh, yeah. Well, I get to enjoy the weather all day, and then the sun starts to go down, and I get to go to a theater and tell stories. So, living the dream.
Well, lots of choices of music from the show. Let's go with a classic from of Peter Allen's that he wrote in collaboration with several musicians and was made most famous by Christopher Cross, Arthur's Theme, The Best That You Can Do. Thanks, Justin. Have a great run.
Thanks so much, David.
you get caught between the moon and New York City. That was referred, a self-biographical reference to Peter Allen, singer-songwriter, now immortalized in his own show, The Boy from Oz, with Justin Jenna. Theater Rhino, therhino.org for more information. It's got another two-week run, last performance on the 17th of this month. Catch it if you can. Peter Robinson will be by shortly with some movie reviews. And if you want to explore your classical end of your entertainment weekend, conductor Jakub Hrusa returns to lead the San Francisco Symphony in a powerful program featuring socially resonant and creatively defiant works by Béla Bartók and Dmitri Shostakovich at Davey Symphony Hall. Violinist Karen Gomio makes her San Francisco Symphony subscription debut with performances of Shostakovich's Sardonic Violin Concerto No. 1, a work that the composer kept hidden for years, faced with the harsh reality of arts censorship during Stalin's regime. It was finally premiered by David Oistrakh in 1955, 2 years after Stalin's death. Bartók's ballet score to the Miraculous Mandarin, also a victim of arts censorship, is also on the program, as is Borodin's Patriotic Symphony No. 2, full of Slavic character and distinctly Russian melodies. I caught up with the violin soloist, Karen Gomio, at Davies Symphony Hall yesterday afternoon. Karen, thank you for taking some time after rehearsing the Shostakovich today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, you are no stranger to this stage here in San Francisco with the symphony, making a debut in 2007 for the Summer in the Series concerts, performing Tchaikovsky Violin Concerto. Then you came back in 2012. Have you made any other visits to the Bay Area?
I don't think I have. It's a very, very beautiful and special part of the country, so I'm super happy to be back this week, and we've had great weather, so that's been a plus.
Have you worked with this particular maestro before?
Yes, I have. This will be our fourth or fifth time. I don't remember. We met in 2011. That was the first time we worked together, and since then we've covered a number of repertoire, and we've done Shostakovich previously in Bamberg with his orchestra, so...
You have a really big commitment to contemporary music and composers, and which included a big work this past May with a good friend of both the radio station and me, Sam Adams, his Violin Concerto, also a very big work.
Yes, that was really exciting and terrifying. Terrifying just because, you know, when you know that you're performing something brand new for the first time, there's that added responsibility of, you know, trying to first of all, digest it as much as you can so that it becomes, you know, close to second nature, and to then perform it in as convincing a way as possible. But it was such a wonderful opportunity to get to work with Sam. We had plenty of time beforehand, also in between rehearsals with the orchestra. So that was, it was a very joyful sort of thing to do. Tremendous work he wrote. I mean, it turned out to be a 5-movement, 35-minute long piece. So, that was such a great experience.
I should mention that was part of the Chicago Symphony's Music Now series under conductor Esa-Pekka Salonen. Someone that you've worked with?
No, it was my first time. Yeah, first time with the orchestra and conductor. It's just incredible. Yeah.
Well, you're playing on an amazing instrument, a 1703 Aurora Ex Fulis Stradivarius. Tell us a little bit about what you've learned about Stradivarius, especially since you were in a recent documentary done by NHK Japan, was it, on the mysteries of the Supreme Violin?
Yes, very interesting question. It's a very deep question. I think, you know, we haven't really found an answer about what makes Stradivarius so exquisite and so outstanding. You know, people have tested, and this was part of the documentary too, which I got to be involved in, and it was so fascinating to visit not just violin makers and but also the forest ranger and the area apparently where Strad got the wood logs, and also we went to radiology center. So, I mean, you know, we visited all kinds of experts in all sorts of fields that have any sort of tool to experiment on, whether it's the measurements or the varnish, the contents in the varnish, or, you know, the wood, the density of the wood, the age of the wood, everything. And yeah, to this day, we don't really know what the answer is. All I can say about my violin is that, you know, we've now had about a 17-year-long relationship, which is incredible. I feel extremely grateful because it's a continuing relationship that keeps to change and grow, just like any human relationship, I would say. I mean, if this is built in 1703, you know, it's got that kind of complexity, which I think only takes time for the player to understand better and better.
How did you actually come across this Stradivarius as opposed to another type of violin or from a different sponsor? Or what? How does one go about acquiring, at least for use, a violin of this stature?
Yeah, well, it's really sort of a lucky situation for me. When my mother and I first moved to New York, we'd moved from Montreal, and, you know, it was a very difficult time financially, and I was still, I think, on a 3/4 size violin at that point. But one thing led to another, and sort of ended up living next to this family that took interest in my growth and my studies, and eventually said, well, you know, we heard that a Strat is a good investment. If we purchased one for our investment purposes, would you play it? And it was sort of like, are you kidding me? So that's how it happened. And then I had the incredible luxury of spending a year looking at about, oh, I don't remember now, you know, somewhere between 6 to 10 great instruments, including Strats, but not all Strats. And so this one stood out to me because, you know, they say, I mean, it's, again, same with people, right? It's all about the chemistry. So this violin somehow spoke to me in a special way. And I had this instinct about it that it had been sheltered, but in a very loving way, and that it had more to give. And then later on, I found out that, sure enough, it's only been in the hands of 2 owners in the past century, which is quite rare, because often these instruments, you know, will be passed around from hand to hand, owner to owner. So it was really neat to discover that, you know, it had sort of been dormant, living with just a couple of families in one century. And the more I played it and the more I had worked on it, the more it did seem to blossom and open up. So,
Could you maybe give us a little demonstration of something that is unique about this instrument that you can point out to it, to say some amateur ears that may not have heard of Stradivarius before?
Interesting question. You know, what I can say is, I think the difference in, let's say, a Strad versus, I don't know, it's hard to say what else, but, you know, something maybe slightly, slightly inferior, let's say, is the way it responds in a large space. So in a large concert hall, the violin really comes alive. And obviously, I'm the one playing the instrument on the stage, so I've never been able to hear myself in a distance. But the comments that I've often gotten is that the sound, it's not so much that it's loud, but that there's a pearly, clear, pure quality that somehow seems to carry all the way to the back of the hall.
Do you use different violins for different purposes, or is this the one you mainly want to use because of its history?
Well, this is the one and only that I practice on, perform on, so on. I mean, you know, again, it's just, there's so much complexity to one single violin that, you know, practicing on it is becomes really important just to get to know it physically. I mean, it's all super subtle, but not only physically, but also sound-wise. And again, it's a living, breathing thing. So, you know, I might pick it up tomorrow and it might feel different from how it felt today. So it's a process of getting to know each other constantly.
Would you be willing to treat us to just a little bit of Bach on this amazing instrument?
Sure. Let me play maybe a little bit of the Sarabande from the second partita.
just beautiful. On the 1703 Stradivarius, a little touch of Johann Sebastian Bach. Thanks you so much, Karen.
You're very welcome.
Let's move on to a little bit of a discussion of the Shostakovich Concerto. It was what you did with the Shreveport Symphony back in September. It was written in 1948, but didn't have its airing until many years later. For me, some of the great moments of the work are in that third movement, Passacaglia, where we have these plodding low brass pulses, and then you're just doing some wonderful things on top of it. What are some highlights of this work for you?
Yeah, so I actually go way back with this concerto. I heard it for the first time, I think, when I was about 13 or 14, a recording of David Oistrakh and Mravinsky conducting the Leningrad Philharmonic. I think at that point, it was the first time that I had heard Shostakovich, and together, I think even on that CD, was the 11th Symphony, also conducted by Mravinsky. And so I just got so deeply intrigued by these works, and even drew a bit of a parallel, because even though the 11th Symphony is later, and it's about a specific occurrence, the 1906 Revolution, but just the way the structure of the symphony, I find, is quite similar to the structure of the violin concerto. The violin concerto is also in four movements. The first movement is this sort of brooding, very dark nocturne. It's called the nocturne, but it's almost like anticipating something terrible to happen. And so it's sort of, you have these emotions, but they're very much suppressed. And then you've got the second movement, which is this eruptive, demonic kind of a dance. And then you've got the third movement, as you said, which is just stunning. And it's, you've got, yeah, the bass line, the Passacaglia, just running through the whole movement, and then you've got the orchestra, the strings, which are kind of like a chorale, and then you've got the solo voice on top, which is almost like this single spoken voice telling the story of what just happened, and that culminates into this famous cadenza, which is quite lengthy, and it could be a work on its own because there's so much going on. It starts very in a meditative sort of way, and then more and more emotion gets involved, and then that erupts into the fourth movement, which is this final kind of this, I don't know, this fight scene or this victorious kind of movement. So that's the way I see it.
I should reiterate that I'm talking with you in the dressing room at Davies Symphony Hall with your open violin case with the Stradivarius in beautiful view. And as violinists often do, photos and keepsakes up by where you keep the bows. And there's that picture of David Oistrakh, who was instrumental, of course, in working with Shostakovich and bringing this concerto to life. One of the things that he mentioned apparently in the composition of the work to Shostakovich is that a massive cadenza, and saying that it went right into the last movement and that there was no time for him to even wipe the sweat from his brow. And he I'm going to have a little quote here. He had said, Dmitri Dmitrievich, please consider letting the orchestra take over the first eight bars in the finale so as to give me a break. Then at least I can wipe the sweat off of my brow. And he actually did that for him. He added an eight-bar phrase so the orchestra could hear the opening theme rather than having you work through all that.
Yes, thank goodness for that.
Well, next week you're off to Edmonton, performances of Mozart and Cologne in December. What are you looking forward to in the next year?
In the next year. Wow. Well, I'm excited about playing Petrus Vasks' Vox Amoris. So, you know, you mentioned earlier that I like working with contemporary works. So that's one thing. The other thing is that recently I've, for the very first time in my life, played the three Bach partitas in performance. It was a very scary but also exhilarating and ultimately rewarding experience. And so this is my personal project, is to work towards being able to perform the three Bach sonatas next time.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll look forward to hearing those in some way, either in person or when you make a recording of them. Thank you so much for taking some time today, Karen, and best performances here in San Francisco.
Thank you so much.
Let's hear just a little bit of that massive cadenza from the third movement from the Passacaglia movement, which leads into the raucous burlesque movement. Music of Dmitri Shostakovich from the Violin Concerto No. 1 in A minor. Violin Concerto No. 1 in A minor. Dmitri Shostakovich. You'll hear Karen Gomio as the soloist with the San Francisco Symphony. Jakub Hrusa conducting. Tonight at 8, Friday at 8, Saturday at 8. sfsymphony.org for more information. Also on the program, Borodin's Symphony No. 2 in the suite from the Miraculous Mandarin of Béla Bartók. Banned and boycotted. Music of Bartók and Shostakovich. Russian music will figure prominently in one of our reviews from our regular contributor, Peter Robinson, but he's also got some other things for you to do if you'd rather not venture out. How about some binge watching might be on the agenda for Peter's reviews? Hi, Peter.
Yeah, hi, David. Good to be here. And I think this is an interesting thing about how you see a movie, because this week I'm covering a Netflix and an Amazon primetime movies, which, of course, you can see at home. And then I'm going out into the great outdoors to see Can You Ever Forgive Me? And I think it raises in my own mind the difference between watching a movie at home on, you know, maybe a small screen or a regular screen, and then the difference to sitting in a theater and taking in the big screen with all the sound effects and photographic effects. But today, both Netflix and Amazon Prime Time are offering some choices that you simply cannot get on the big screen. And the first, which I'm going to highly recommend, is called Bodyguard. It's a story about an Afghan soldier, a British Afghan soldier who's back from the wars. He's now a police sergeant, and it's a great police thriller. It played on the BBC. It comes in essentially six episodes. And in England, it drew over 17 million viewers, which put it in the competitive league with people who might remember Downton Abbey. Now, at the heart of this story, and it's a gripping type of story, is the actor Richard Madden, which people may remember from the Game of Thrones. And the opening episode will totally draw you in. It's set on a train. He is there with his two kids, and suddenly they realize that there is a bomber on the train. And to me, it's one of the most gripping episodes I've seen. You also learn a lot about suicide bombers, how the bombs are made, how they're constructed, and given it's a British situation, how the British police cope with the various levels of SWAT squads and police to deal with the thing. So sit tight in your chair. It's not a spoiler, deals with the bomber, but then he gets appointed as the personal bodyguard, hence the title, to the Home Secretary. And the Home Secretary in this case is a woman. Home Secretary, compared to the American equivalent, is something like Minister of State, involved in all types of security. And the Home Secretary is a highly political person. In this case, she's played by Keeley Hawkes. And it's a movie which could really fall into the category of a John le Carré thriller. There are twists about it. There's police corruption. There's competition between the security forces, MI5, MI6, and the regular police force. And, of course, to keep the movie going, there is forbidden sex. So in between the bouncing around in beds and the creaking of bed springs, we are dealing with a story about contemporary terrorism and how, in a very domestic situation, Great Britain is coping with this. Now, I watched the first four episodes in one sweep, so when David spoke a little early on about binge-watching, this is definitely one of those things that'll keep you gripped. When it played in England, they ran off as episodes, so each week the Brits had to wait to find out what was going to happen next. But it's one of those series, the series again called Bodyguard, which I think reflects on our own situation in this country. How do you deal with terrorists? Who's on whose side? And of course, above all, questions of trust. Can the police trust the security services? Can the politicians trust the police? And what happens if your room is bugged? So I'll say no more.
It is a brand new era of binge watching. Instead of waiting as a cliffhanger would for the next week, you can watch the next episode or the next episode after that.
That's right, yeah. And I think, as I say, you will be totally intrigued. Now, over at Amazon, what I've been looking at is a series which has just been launched. I've seen four of them. It's called The Romanoffs. And this is actually written by the creator of Mad Men, that is Matthew Weiner. And although it's a series, it's really a story of five or six individual episodes. So there is no immediate connection between each of the episodes. But the only connection, and it is a very limited connection, is that each series begins with the execution of the Romanovs. So we're back in Russia in 1918, and as the series develops, one person in each of the different stories has got some type of connection to the Romanovs. I would say it's a mixed bag. The first two episodes were kind of fun. The third one I felt began to go off the rails a little, and then we came back. And is there a connection between Mad Men and this? Well, we are dealing with a different era, a bygone generation. Mad Men took us back to the advertising age in the 1950s and 60s. This takes us back all over the place, but to the lost power of the Romanovs, who, of course, were all executed in the Winter Palace in 1918. And that is the opening sequence of each of them in the individual episodes. So those are two things which you'll stay at home to see. They're not available on the big screen. But I did finally get outside and have seen a film which is playing across the Bay Area in Marin, in San Francisco, and in the East Bay. And it's called Can You Ever Forgive Me? It's had a lot of positive reviews from the reviewers. It's a very interesting story about a biographer who's done a number of celebrity-type biographies, and now she's beginning to fade. She cannot sell her next book. It's actually based on the real life of Lee Israel, and Melissa McCarthy does a great job. So the way she finds a way out is to start forging letters. So it's a story about forgery, but it's also a story about New York, the great settings of New York in the 1990s, the bars, the bookshops. Bookshops, remember bookshops? Oh, yes, they come in too. And what you get is also a story about loneliness. So if you put together forgery, bookshops, loneliness, and great bar scenes, you're beginning to get the feel of how the ambience and the atmosphere really takes over. Now, I've got to say that it is a great acting picture. Richard Grant plays the friend, a kind of flamboyant gay who is deliberately playing opposite, and I think does a great acting job. So this is, to me, a movie that comments on the 1990s and at the same time makes us remember what reading is about, what writing is about, and in this case, what forgery is about. So you've got an interesting back theme, and you've certainly got something which I think captures the spirit of time and the spirit of place.
Can you tell us a little bit about the character that Melissa McCarthy plays, Lee Israel?
Yeah, she does. She plays the writer who is a failed writer after three successful books. And so she has to find a way to make a living. She does have a drinking problem, and the bar scenes kind of bring that to life. She is also a very lonely person, and her real love in life is her cat. So it's a cat movie as well. So now you've got everything going for you. And again, she's a difficult person. And I think one of the great achievements of Melissa McCarthy is to make a difficult person both understandable and lovable. So that, to me, speaks to the quality of the acting.
Also in that cast of Can You Forgive Me, Jane Curtin and Steven Spinella. It's in Bay Area theaters throughout the Bay Area. So check it out.
And you may also like some of the old background music, because they do capture the music that Lee Israel really liked, which is more torch-type music and the kind of slow beat, slightly downbeat, but just the right music for the movie. And maybe just a quick plug on Sunday for those who we started talking about Grace Cathedral. Sunday is Remembrance Day for people who want to go to celebrate or commemorate the First World War. It's a beautiful ceremony. It begins at 3 in England. They call it Poppy Day, and it is a festivity, at the same time a memorial about people whose family or lives were lost during World War I.
GraceCathedral.org for some of the events that are happening there. Thank you very much, Peter. We'll see you next time. And I will see you next time, too, for Open Air next Thursday at 1 o'clock. A reminder that this program will be archived at KALW.org. And a couple of additional reminders. Shostakovich was on this program. Well, Shostakovich figures prominently on Monday evenings at 9 here on KALW as our explorations in music continue with yours truly as host, along with Robert Greenberg and the Alexander String Quartet, exploring the string quartets of Dmitri Shostakovich. Join me this coming Monday evening at 9. And next week, as I mentioned before, I'll be talking with director, actor John Fisher about his solo show, A History of World War II. Also, great friend and composer Jake Heggie will talk about It's a Wonderful Life, that's having its debut at the San Francisco Opera coming up. Also a talk with mezzo-soprano Isabel Leonard, who is the narrator in MTT's composition from the Diary of Anne Frank. That's next week's Open Air. Hope you can join me. This show is archived at KALW.org. My thanks, as always, to Neil Swinkles for producing the show. And if you've got a segment idea, by all means, send me an email. I'm David@KALW.org. Thanks for listening.